From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, ozone levels in Michigan are way too high.
It definitely is a man-made problem that we need to fix.
Change is afoot for Detroit's big auto show.
Mercedes out, BMW out. The British are basically not here. The Swedes are not here.
Advice for parents on social media posts about your kids. Tread lightly.
Parents have to make a lot of decisions about what is okay to share and not to share. And especially as their kids grow up, how will kids feel about seeing photos of themselves online?
A doctor's brush with death gives her new insights into caring for patients.
We don't always say things in a way that promotes healing. We can actually be adversaries to our patients in many ways.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The EPA has handed down a clear message to Michigan. Your air is not clear. It says too many people are living in areas with unacceptable smog levels, and it's given the state 3 years to come up with a plan to clean the air. This is no surprise to the American Lung Association in Michigan. Ken Fletcher is its director of advocacy. Ken, the EPA says nearly half of Michiganders live in areas that have unacceptable smog levels. How does that fit with the State of the Air report your group recently released?
Yes, we've been seeing this for the past couple of reports here that the ozone levels in Michigan are way too high, especially in the Metro Detroit area. We've given fairly low grades, and in this latest report that came out in April, we gave F's, failing grades, for most of the Metro Detroit region. They all are having far too many high ozone days, and we knew that it was above the new standard that took effect, so we knew that they were going to not be in attainment.
Well, then let's talk about this. What counties, what cities in Michigan have been singled out by the EPA for violating these tougher standards for ground-level ozone?
Well, it's the counties in the Metro Detroit area, St. Clair County, Wayne County, Oakland County, Macomb County, Monroe County, Washtenaw County, and then also on the west side of the state, you're seeing Allegan and Muskegon are also out of attainment.
So why are we having more high ozone days with every passing year?
Well, one of the things that we saw, you know, in the report that we issued earlier this year, we do an average of 3 years, and this year's average was for 14, 15, and 16. We know 16 was a very hot summer, and ozone pollution is created when the exhaust from cars and power plants and factories and stuff goes into the air, kind of reacts with the sun and the heat, and forms the ozone pollution. So since it was a really hot summer, we know that that makes things worse when it comes to ozone pollution. So we kind of expected to see an uptick in those numbers, and that's exactly what we saw across the country. We saw things a little higher in terms of ozone, and I think it was in part because of that hot summer of 2016.
Are there other factors besides the hot summer?
Oh, absolutely. It's the sun and the heat helps create the ozone, but it's the pollution that we're putting in the air that's causing it in the first place. If we wasn't putting the fumes from our dirty coal power plants and other sources like that, we wouldn't have ozone created. So it's definitely is a man-made problem that we need to fix. We need to clean up our dirty coal plants. We need to make our cars and autos cleaner. We just need to take steps to make sure that we reduce the amount of pollution that we're putting into the air.
Well, Ken, did not the Obama-era EPA enact rules and actions to clamp down on those factory emissions and those motor vehicle emissions to help clean our air?
Yes, they did, and that's one of the reasons that we're seeing things in non-attainment now is that they changed the standard for ozone based on the science and data that was available, so that 70 parts per billion is what's considered a safe level, and obviously the metro region is above that level. But they also put in place the Clean Power Plan, which is meant to clean up the pollution coming from existing coal-burning power plants to get a 30% reduction by the year 2030, and currently that has been stopped. There's court challenges that our own Attorney General Bill Schuette joined in the court challenge to stop that from happening, and the Trump administration is looking at repealing that.
And to your point, is that the Trump EPA unwinding those same Obama-era actions? So here we have factories and automakers are having emissions rules relaxed, but the EPA is telling the state of Michigan, clean up the air. So what options do we have to address this problem?
Exactly. That's the dilemma. You know, to fix the problem, you have to clean up the power plants. You got to clean up the car exhaust and other sources of pollution. Yet those are the very things that the Trump EPA is saying that we're going to roll back the rules and regulations on. Yet we're going to have to get in attainment and come up with a state implementation plan that explains how we're going to clean up our air.
Without stricter oversight of these emissions, can we get to where the EPA is telling us we need to be?
Oh, no, you're going to have to take steps to clean up the source of the pollution. That's part of what's going to have to happen as the state's put together its plan. You're going to have to figure out exactly what are the sources of the pollution, then find ways to abate those. Now, the good news is, I guess, some of the utilities have announced that they're going to, you know, decommission and shut down some of our existing coal-burning plants, so they may need to speed that up a little bit. So we weren't hugely over the limit. I believe, let's see, Wayne and Macomb County were 72 parts per billion. And as I said, the standard was 70 parts per billion. So, you know, some of these things, if we can get these existing coal burning plants offline and take some other steps, we may be able to come back into attainment fairly easily. But it's going to take some effort, no doubt.
Ken, do you have confidence that this EPA will be a useful partner in this effort?
Well, everything we have seen so far is there's been the budget proposal out of the administration was to actually cut the budget for EPA by about 24-25%. There's no way they're going to be able to effectively enforce the Clean Air Act if they don't have the resources to do that. Then plus all the discussion so far has been how do we roll back the rules that were put in place during the Obama era that was meant to clean up our air, to give us the air that we deserve to breathe. So if they're rolling back all those regulations and allowing more pollution to go into the air, you're just going to see more areas come into non-attainment, and then we'll have to take steps. So it just really doesn't make sense the direction that we're seeing coming out of the EPA these days.
Ken Fletcher, Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Michigan. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the program.
Decades, January in Southeast Michigan has meant auto show. Thousands trek to Cobo Center for the North American International Auto Show, often picking their way through snow and ice. But Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here to tell us the snow might give way to autumn leaves. What's going on, Daniel?
Well, the Detroit Auto Dealers Association, the organizers of the show, are deep in a reexamination of the auto show. I think largely driven by the fact that people are not coming. The European automakers have essentially abandoned Detroit.
Well, now, when you say people, you talking about auto companies? Because this past auto show drew over 756,000 people, and
no,
that was up.
No, but I think that this show has, for a long time, prided itself as being a must-do stop on the global auto show circuit. Mm-hmm. I think the evidence is pretty clear that that's not the case anymore.
So the auto companies are not coming.
Right. I mean, that executives had to be here. They had to be seen. They had to use it as an opportunity to network and potentially to talk business behind the scenes. And yet here we are at the end of this year's show, Mercedes out, BMW out. The British are basically not here. The Swedes are not here. With the exception of FCA's two Italian brands, Alfa and Fiat, you know, they have essentially abandoned the show. I think that's really ringing some alarm bells. People are feeling that this is not, people in the industry, that this is not a must-do. And there's been a lot of complaints about the weather over the years, and the auto dealers have basically parried it and say, we want to be the first show of the year, and we want to be able to drive sales in the first quarter. Well, I got news for you. The business has changed. Companies don't just launch products in the fall. They launch them all year round. They use the internet and all sorts of other targeted marketing to reach audiences they want to reach, whether they're customers, media. They don't need an auto show to make their executives available to the media. They can do that anytime.
So what would moving to October give them?
Their argument is it won't be too hot, so it won't tax Cobo's ability to keep the show cool because you've got all those lights and all those displays, plus all the people and everything else.
Totally appreciate that.
And that can be an issue. that there's a lot of outstanding issues of summer dates that are already on Kobo's schedule that can't be changed easily. They see this as kind of a sweet spot. The weather can still be nice, although, you know, October in Michigan can be a crapshoot. You just don't know. Oh, you live in the middle of the Great Lakes.
Well, but they've been living with a crapshoot for January for all these decades.
Oh, exactly. Truth to be told. So I think they're moving in that direction, but I think their analysis is somewhat, and they shared it with me, traditional in their thinking. And as a result, you've got a company like General Motors that is saying, hey, wait a minute. We got a different idea here. Why not do this in June? Why not tie it in some ways to the Grand Prix on Belle Isle, open up downtown and all of its venues to all sorts of festivals and concerts and product reveals and ride and drives and demos of autonomous vehicles, and show Detroit at its absolute best. And if anybody's been down to the Grand Prix when it's not raining and cold, they know that there are a few things that make Detroit look better than that Grand Prix. It's pretty spectacular. Now, that would only just be part of it. So General Motors has been pushing this idea on the DADA, and frankly, I'm not sure that they're going to make the sale. In fact, I don't think they will. But there are competing visions, and I think there's a belief at the car companies that auto shows, as we have understood them, and certainly as we've understood them in this community for 30 years, next January will be the 30th year of the international part of the Detroit Auto Show, the North American International Auto Show. That industry has so changed just in the past 5 years. And I think that by the time we get to the 2020 show, who knows what this industry is going to look like and what the priorities are. But I think clearly people feel like they don't need to be at these shows. I know it's a challenge for us as a hometown paper that covers the industry all over the world to really gin up news during the auto show, because in a lot of cases, the newsmakers just aren't here and they just aren't available.
Change is coming, possibly, for the North American International Auto Show. How likely is it that 2019 Auto Show is the last one in January?
I'd say it's pretty likely. I think they're going to have to make a call here. I think the real concern is that they make the call for October, and a couple, 3 years hence, they realize it's not enough. And then do they have to move it again, or do they have to totally redo the show? I think that's one of the questions they've got to answer.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For the rest of this hour, we will revisit some of our favorite conversations that we've had recently, like this one about a crazy popular Michigan beer. You may know M43 as that state road that runs through Williamston on past Lansing, a.k.a. Grand River. But more and more beer lovers are recognizing M43 as their favorite brew. This New England-style India Pale Ale has made a world of difference for Old Nation Brewing Company in Williamston. And they may have another hit on their hands with a tart strawberry M43. Travis Fritz is co-owner of Old Nation Brewing Company. Hey, Travis.
Hey, how are you?
Very good. So you opened Old Nation in 2015?
In June of 2015, yeah.
Okay, and how were things going for you before M43?
Well, slowly. Like most new breweries, we, you know, struggled to kind of make a name for ourselves and differentiate ourselves from other breweries in the state. Michigan, as a lot of people know, is a really competitive state with regard to beer. We have a lot of great breweries here in the state. So I've been a brewer for 15 or 16 years and certainly was not ready for the level of competition when putting a new brand set on the open market. And we weren't making as much as we had anticipated, which is difficult. We opened a relatively large brewery right from the get-go and needed to make a lot in order to sustain it. So for a smaller brewery, we were certainly making plenty of beer. We had a couple of legacy brands, but for a brewery the size that we built, we were struggling.
And you have said you misread the Michigan beer market, and that kind of led to those early struggles. How so? What do Michigan beer drinkers want?
Well, again, in any competitive market, I think, with any consumer good, there is a need to make a sort of a statement with whatever product you're making. So it's not enough that the product is just good. It has to also either speak to someone on the kind of a personal level or sort of set itself apart from the rest of the crowd and whatever good that is that you're talking about. And I think beer is no exception here in Michigan. So So I think when we started brewing beer here at Old Nation, we came out with a number of old-fashioned brands, that is to say styles of beer. Most of them were continental European beers, some English beer. We had looked outside of Michigan for trends. I think when anybody opens a business, they want to open it for the coming year or years. And that's what we were trying to do. And we saw that on the West and East Coast, a lot of these traditional styles were gaining in popularity. It was in, you know, my wheelhouse and my brewing partner Nate's wheelhouse. It's the kind of beer we've been doing for, you know, 15, 16 years of professional brewing. But as it turns out, what was happening on the East and West Coast was not what was happening here in Michigan. As a competitive market, you really needed something to set yourself apart. And that, I think, is why we were struggling initially and why M43 was so important to our development.
So those kind of traditional German and Belgian style brewers, they were fine, but they weren't making you stand out.
Well, right. I think from a brewer's perspective, they're great, right? Because they're very technical beers. They're challenging to make, and they're challenging to make consistently. And again, for sort of technical brewers like Nate, who graduated from UC Davis, and myself, who graduated from the Technical University in Berlin, those were the kind of beers we were interested in making.
And Nate is your head brewer.
He's our head brewer, yeah, Nate Rixey.
Okay, so you stumble on this idea of a New England IPA. So what is that?
Well, it's an IPA. I think a lot of people who drink craft beer are familiar with IPAs as a brand that's very hop-forward. So not only is there a great deal of bitterness in traditional American IPAs, but there's a great deal of hop flavor and aroma, which can commonly present itself, at least traditionally, as kind of a pine flavor, maybe even a spruce flavor, some grapefruit sometimes. A New England IPA is a completely different approach to the hop. I think it maybe even is unfortunate that it carries the IPA label, because it's so very different from what people are used to drinking. The hops generally present themselves in really high-impact aromas, and characteristically are the aromas of orange or mango or papaya or pineapple. And these are newer hop strains that are grown mostly in the Pacific Northwest of the United States. Generally, very, very low bitterness in New England IPAs. Frankly, the bitterness is more like a Central European Pilsner, so there, but really only to balance the sweetness of the malt. And I think what's most striking about these beers to folks is that they're visually appealing. They're very cloudy. They're a lot like, if anyone's familiar with German Hefeweizen beer. So they catch light in a really interesting way, and I think maybe in the Instagram era, that visual impact is sort of what carries the day for these beers. But they're also very approachable. Again, not as bitter as traditional IPAs, and with a great deal of hop flavor and aroma.
And you say that kind of touch of fruitiness.
Sure, right. And that's largely coming from the hops. We and others who make this style also are using yeast strains, English yeast strains largely, which produce what are called phenols during fermentation. And those phenols can present themselves as kind of a ripe apricot, almost an overripe peach aroma. So all of the aroma and flavor from the hops and aroma and flavor from yeast and the different malts that we're using kind of work together in concert in order to create this fruity, juicy beverage which has no fruit or juice in it.
Boy, that does sound very appealing, because regular IPA, not my cup of tea, because of that bitterness, not my cup of tea. Sorry about that.
You're not alone. Yeah, you're not alone. And I think for Nate and I, who are, of course, beer drinkers as well as brewers, it had become much less appealing to make New England IPAs because we, frankly, felt a lot like you do. I mean, they're really interesting beers, traditional IPAs, but I think the envelope had been pushed far enough in those beers. And frankly, as that envelope was pushed in terms of high bitterness and extremely high piney hop flavor, I think we lost a lot of craft beer drinkers as brewers. And I don't know that New England IPA is necessarily pulling those folks back in, but certainly we've gotten a lot of feedback from folks who, like you, didn't really care for IPAs and now really like the M43.
And M43 has got you now, what, you were selling some 1,200 barrels in 2016, and what, you're on track to selling some 20,000 barrels this year?
Well, it's early in the year.
You don't want to jinx yourself.
Right. Right now we're brewing at a clip to make about 21,000 barrels or so. We assume, as most do, that seasonality will pick up. That is to say, there is the presence of seasonality in our forecast in the summer when sales almost always pick up for everybody. So we feel like 20 to 21,000 barrels is a relatively conservative estimate of what we'll be making this year. We're certainly ready to.
So things have changed a lot from those slow early months when you opened in 2015. Let's say that.
They absolutely have. Again, staring, you know, the debt of a business that wasn't growing as fast as we'd like it to down is, is pretty difficult. And not having to do that and having a beer that, you know, practically sells itself and has become really popular is something I don't know that I've ever been so thankful in my life. And I think, you know, my wife, who runs our restaurant, and Nate, feel the exact same way. So we're just really, really thankful for what's happening now.
If you just joined us, I'm talking with Travis Fritz, who's co-owner of Old Nation Brewery in Williamston. And M43, their New England-style IPA, is really taking Michigan by storm. And one of the things you did in developing M43 was you engaged with craft beer enthusiasts. But you say that's kind of a taboo in the brewing world?
It certainly has been. I think that's changing, and certainly I don't think that we sort of precipitated that change, but I think a good way to think about it is, you know, these craft beer enthusiasts are big fans of beer, and they can commonly be big fans of one brewery or another, much the way that sports fans are. For example, you know, I might be a big football fan, and I might be a big Lions fan and not like other teams.
Got it.
So quite often, those guys will get together and make these really strong judgments on these craft beer pages, and they, like anyone, want to stick to their judgments and don't like when those are challenged. So I think a brewer going onto those social media pages would be a lot like an athlete from another team going on those social media pages for sports and trying to plead their case. Not received very well,
yeah.
Generally not heard out, and not welcome quite often. So, that's why I think it was a taboo, but for us it was extremely powerful to make that connection.
Because what did you learn from that connection?
I learned that a great deal of my own dogma was pretty ridiculous. I mean, what I developed over 15 years or so of brewing as this kind of, you know, I thought was a nobility of brewing really classic styles and really scientifically technical brewing, and had kind of lost the point of the fun in all of this. And I think that these guys are as enthusiastic as the enthusiast name suggests, and that was really infectious. So for us, we began to have fun and sort of combine what we learn as students and tradesmen for, you know, most of our adult lives into that just spirit of having a good time. And I think folks feel like you can taste that in the M43.
Now, I know M43 is pretty available at craft beer shops in Michigan, and you can also get it when you go to Ford Field, right?
You can, yeah. The Lions organization and the company that runs their food service were extraordinarily gracious and asked us in. And we've done well there, although it's not a big portion of our sales. Mm-hmm. It certainly is, I guess, for the ego, it's nice to be in those kind of places.
Indeed. Well, what about plans to expand distribution and get it outside of Michigan?
We are working on that feverishly, even now. So the amount of growth that we've experienced and have answered with new equipment, that process has been relatively grueling, but we're more or less past that now. The building we're in is more or less full of tanks, and we are looking at more spots here in Williamston and even farther afield in order to just kind of supply the demand. But certainly at the end of this summer, we'll have a better picture of what demand actually is, and we'll make those moves in 2019 probably.
Travis Fritz is co-owner of Old Nation Brewery in Williamston and the creator of M43, the New England-style IPA that has become one of the most in-demand beers in Michigan. Travis, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's talk about Celtic music. Here's a tune called the Monaghan Jig, done in Ireland in traditional style. And now, here's the very same jig served up by the Southeast Michigan group Nessa. Nessa reimagines the ballads and dance tunes of the old Celtic world, bringing in a wide range of musical styles. The ensemble is led by Kelly McDermott, who plays the flute and sings, and she is back with us now on Stateside. Welcome back, Kelly.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and I first want to start out by saying I absolutely love your show.
Thank you.
And I'm just amazed by the variety of programs, so it's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to be able to talk about your music because it is wonderful. And you have a new EP.
Yes.
And it's called Travel Walk to Celtica.
Yes.
We started out with a taste, giving people an idea of how Nessa reinvents these tunes. Some of them are who knows how old and written by who knows. They've been kicking around in Ireland and Scotland for years. What do you love about these old Celtic melodies?
That's such a good question. I actually sometimes try to not reject this passion that I have, but to seek other types of music, folk or, you know, maybe Italian folk or some French or German. I definitely am attracted to Japanese music and Indian music, as in India. And I just keep coming back to this Celtic music. It's just it's so deep in my cells. And it's to me, it's just a calling. It's a passion that I live with. And I just have to accept it.
Well, I want to listen to another cut now from this new EP from Nessa. Let's take a listen to Travel Walk. There are many ways to put Celtic music out there. My daughter spent some 15 years in competitive Irish dance, so we've sat in a lot of conference centers listening to that traditional style with fiddle, accordion, and flute. There's Celtic rock like Black 47 and Flogging Molly, certainly Enya and the New Age Celtic. Yours is different from all of that. How do you describe your sound?
Well, I've done a fair amount of research studying what Celtic fusion is, and it really first started in the American South, where you have the Appalachian, Scottish, Irish, some African American, and just basic country music. And there's a quote somewhere I read about it. Basically, all when you dissect it down to the most common denominator, most of our American music, even jazz, comes from shades of Irish and Scottish. But for me, when I study the fusion aspect of it, it's quite natural because I'm a classical flutist, have degrees in classical flute, and have worked mostly in classical music most of my life. And my husband, Rob, who is my partner in the band, he has degrees in jazz, upright bass. And this beautiful man, Mike List, plays hand drums, and he's studied in India, he's studied tabla, and just many places around the world. And then Dan Palmer is, and when he plays with Nessa, we call him Dan McPalmer. he's a really fun guy. He has degrees in classical guitar and jazz, and he teaches, you know, in some of the colleges in Michigan, both classical and jazz. So when you put us together, it just naturally has all these elements that are hard to really pinpoint, but you definitely can feel it. And this EP, I have to say, is dedicated to my two children, Emma and Spencer, and my godson, Terry, who are 16, 19, and 21. So I am around pop music all the time and rap music all the time. And I wanted to dedicate this music to them, and I wanted to bring in some EDM and, you know, call it Celtica.
Song the arm will make strong. Also, my shoulder to carry on. Leave me, the challenge will be overcome. If I can but give you the occasional song.
I'm wondering, when Nessa is out there playing live, you've got an audience in front of you, and you talk to people who follow Nessa, can you tell if you're bringing new listeners into the Celtic music fold?
Actually, that's a very good point. I have had people say to me, now I like Celtic music, or now you make me want to listen to Celtic music. So, you know, we're not a big pub band. We really love playing festivals, listening rooms, performing arts series, and libraries, actually. And the library audience I'm in love with, because the people are just there to absorb and just take in all of the music.
Not to sing rebel songs and drink beer.
Yeah, and they kind of get the classical thing that comes through. And very often I just have people thanking me and saying, you know, you brought me such joy and I never understood this music before. So it's definitely a mission.
What's next for Nessa?
Well, after our EP release, we're actually composing music, not just the EP. I'm composing a spring suite, which has shades of classical and some jigs. And Rob and Dan have written some music for that spring suite. After that, my daughter and I are going to Ireland, so I hope to study and pick up as much as I can to bring back. And then we have a summer full of festivals in Ohio, Indiana.
In fact, I checked your website, and anyone who wants to see Nessa play live, there are dates in Michigan and Ohio through the spring and summer, and all you have to do is go to nessamusic.com, and that's N-E-S-S-A music.com. Kelly McDermott, great fun, wonderful music. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, a near-death experience as a patient gives a physician new insights into communicating with patients. That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. You know, it wasn't all that long ago when proud parents might carry a small photo album, which they would happily whip out and show off photos of their kids. How quaint that all now sounds. Today, parents have so many options for sharing photos of the kids on social media. One study finds over 90% of new parents upload photos of their children to Facebook. A study in the United Kingdom found parents post nearly 200 photos of their kids under five every year. So you think about that. That means by the time a child turns five, he or she could have at least 1,000 photos of themselves living online. Sarita Shanebeck is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Information. She and her team developed a study exploring a pretty important question. What do kids think about their parents oversharing on social media? Sarita, always good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Parents might say, well, hey, family and friends, they expect to see photos, and if I don't share them, grandma will. Is that a fair point?
It is, and parents have to make a lot of decisions about what is okay to share and not to share, and especially as their kids grow up, how will kids feel about seeing photos of themselves online that they may have had little control over what was shared and who could see it.
What is it you think parents actually get from sharing those kids' photos?
They get validation, especially newer parents, parents of young babies, which is if you're a new parent and you're saying, am I doing this right? Am I raising them well? Are they healthy? Putting a photo up, even if it's not the original intention, when they put a photo of a baby, it gets lots of likes, lots of comments, and there's validation there. It says you're a good parent, you're a good mother, a good father, and that's supportive, and that's important for parents.
But then, as you say, there are these ramifications that perhaps parents haven't considered.
Sure. Babies certainly can't speak to how they feel about having their photos shared, but as kids grow up, they can. And we did a study with 10 to 17-year-old children and teenagers about how do they feel about their parents sharing about them online, because they are now old enough to be very aware of and conscientious of their online identities.
And certainly, as you say, a one-year-old isn't going to be the least bit squirmy about a photo on Facebook, but boy, a 10-year-old surely can be, and it certainly goes even more for teens. So what did they tell you?
They had a variety of preferences. Some kinds of photos and content are okay to share. So these are generally positive things, things like doing well in school or a soccer game or a nice family vacation, something that shows them in a generally good light, shows the family being fairly happy and content. The things they were opposed to were negative content, bad grades, punishment, performing poorly in some way, family arguments, and they were definitely opposed to embarrassing content. And for younger kids, this might be baby photos. For adolescents, it's girlfriends and boyfriends in their peer group. They don't want parents sharing that stuff about them.
So are you saying
don't share the baby photos, or what kind of?
No, interestingly, yeah. So that often is the instinct when I talk to parents. They say, "Oh, I share too much. I shouldn't share so much." And we ask kids, "How do you feel about that sharing?" And they're not opposed to it. So children are okay with their parents sharing about them online, but they want it to be not too often, and they want to have some say over what is shared. And so we ask them about permission. That is, should parents ask permission of their children before they share about them online? And kids say, not all the time, but sometimes. Kids are more likely than parents to say, we would like our parents to ask permission before they share about us, at least some of the time. And the interesting thing is that parents agree. So parents themselves say they should ask permission more often than they actually do.
So they're accepting what the kids are saying.
So they're not totally out of alignment. They both feel like this is not such a bad thing, but let's have a little bit of conversation about what is okay to share or not.
Did you find any differences, Sarita, in views depending on which social media platform is being used?
There are definitely norms. Facebook is, as many have said, now the site for parents and for adults and older people, which actually makes it more okay for families to be connected there and sharing there because that's the norm. Instagram is more for children's peer groups, and so that's less okay, but also less likely that parents are going to be there. Snapchat is very much a personal, smaller network where kids may have just a few friends. By a few, I mean 30 to 50. It is not the norm for parents to be in there sharing with that friend group.
Well, I don't think we need to see parents putting like puppy dog faces or kitty cat faces, those weird filters. That does seem to be the world that the kids are inhabiting more than mom and dad, because you're right, the kids have kind of fled from Facebook once we parents got on there. So what do you think parents need to take away from your research, particularly when we're talking about new parents? We'll start with that first.
New parents should be thoughtful about not only what are the privacy and identity implications of sharing about my baby now, but as they grow up, as they are 5 years old and 10 years old and 20 years old, how will they feel about having this online identity crafted throughout their childhood? Will they want control over it? And so it doesn't mean don't share, but it does mean be conscientious about what is okay to share and how will they feel about it in the long run, having this information out there online.
And then as the kids get older, you're saying it's certainly not a bad thing to respect them by saying, hey, do you mind if I post this?
Yeah, and even just asking that a few times will give you a sense of what kinds of things are they typically okay with and not okay with, and then you can try to follow that a little more closely so you don't have to ask them every time after that, but you'll have a sense of they like this stuff and they don't like that kind of stuff.
What are your thoughts based on the study you've done when you see a parent upload some video of their toddler doing some typically toddler thing, having a meltdown over something? One that comes to mind was somebody, a parent, was clearly had the camera on in the back seat, and the little girl was in the back seat and discovered that she was going to have a brother or sister and lost her mind. And of course, it got posted and it went viral and it was everywhere. Should you think twice before you put up that what you think is adorable toddler meltdown video?
A lot of this varies by parents' own preferences about how private and how public they are. Some parents are very private and they don't want anything shared, and some are very public, so they do YouTube videos about their family, and so their child's birth through child development is documented online in the form of video with many, many viewers. And so parents should be thoughtful about where do they fall on that spectrum. There's no one right rule for every parent, but when they disclose things that are particularly sensitive, like meltdowns and tantrums, which are fun, people enjoy it, people relate, and so there's something about that.
We've all been there.
Yeah, any parent has been there, and so there's some benefits there. You understand it's not just me. There's some sort of socializing that takes place. But as a parent, you want to be just thoughtful about this is out there, and it's not going to be removed, and are you okay with that? And some parents will be, and that's okay.
Sarita Shainaback, assistant professor at the U of M School of Information. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It began with unbearable pain, an alarming development for a woman 7 months pregnant. And before too long, Dr. Rena Audish was losing her grip on life.
All at once, I felt a sudden release and lightness. I could see the operating room clearly, although I struggled to orient myself. The view was deceptive, in the way pilots staring for too long at the horizon can sometimes suffer sensory illusions that cause them to mistake the sea for the sky. My orientation was inverted. I was falling up. I could see the frustrated anesthesiologist who was working on placing IV access as I crashed. I could see the monitoring equipment surrounding me, the obstetrical team readying with instruments to extract the baby. I could see myself on the table. It struck me that they were right. They were losing me. If I could see myself, perhaps I was already lost. I felt nothing. The pain miraculously gone. The panic surrounding the pain was gone. An anodyne peace. I felt weightless, buoyant, and very small. I watched the events unfold before me, unattached to any outcome, with an easy stillness. I had died.
Dr. Audish did not die, but she had to endure a very long, very tough recovery from the medical crisis that cost her the life of her unborn child. And as a physician who cared for patients in the intensive care unit, she learned profound lessons about how doctors and nurses practice medicine. Dr. Audish is with the Department of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine at Henry Ford Health System. Her new memoir is called In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. Dr. Rena Audish, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there you were, having what appeared to be a good, uneventful pregnancy, and then you're literally brought to your knees with pain?
That's right. I was 7 months pregnant when the pain came on out of nowhere.
And you wound up on an operating table and then in the ICU where you had been working at the very hospital at the where you worked as a physician. What happened to you?
We didn't know at the time, but I had a tumor in my liver that grows with pregnancy, and pregnancy is a very dangerous time for that reason. They're called hepatic adenomas. And it basically burst open while I was at dinner. And in the space of really 2 hours, I lost my entire blood volume into my abdomen, which led to most of my organs shutting down. I had kidney failure. My liver failed. I was unable to breathe unassisted. I was placed on life support, and I had a stroke from the lack of blood flow. So I really went from a critical care physician one moment to a critically ill patient. I had specifically targeted my own hospital. I felt that if anyone could help me, it would be us. I really believed in the care that we provided. And so that was a very purposeful decision to drive to Henry Ford.
So it's fair to say you were slammed with about as severe a medical crisis as could be. How long before it took you to get back to good health? And we should note, as we mentioned, sadly, you did lose your unborn baby. So you had that to deal with as well as the physical recovery.
Yes. And to be honest, as a physician, I knew how fortunate I was to recover from that catastrophic hemorrhage. And while certainly the loss of the baby was a sad moment for our family, it was not in any way unexpected. I was amazed that I had survived that and felt very grateful for the care that I had received. All in all, it actually took 8 years to recover, 5 surgeries and many ICU admissions and procedures.
What most surprised you as a patient about the things that were done and said by your doctors and nurses as you went through this ordeal?
What surprised me the most was really how poorly trained we are to give bad news well. I knew the people caring for me, they are tremendously skilled, and I really respect the work that they do and that we all do. But what I realized was hard was telling me things about my kidneys failing or when the baby had died. Those things were actually hard for my providers to do well. And I recognized, you know, I similarly had trouble giving bad news well and really focusing on the emotional needs of my patients. They did an unbelievable job with the clinical care. And I believe I survived something that was truly unsurvivable. But I was left with this feeling of gosh, we don't always say things in a way that promotes healing. We can actually be adversaries to our patients in many ways.
Well, and you write in your book, and I'll quote you here, "Medicine is a culture that does not indulge suffering, though it is everywhere. It is the most important thing to attend to, and we are constantly dismissing it, pushing it aside, whether it's our own suffering or the patient's suffering or our family's suffering. We push it aside to get to the patient." Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that's a product of our training. Medical training really is so focused on the disease itself. It's something we're enamored by. We chase it. And you'll still hear physicians say this is a really good case when it's something catastrophic for the person who's suffering with it. And our orientation is really to the disease itself. We are looking for it in patients without always an understanding of how it impacts them, how their course of their life is changed by these diagnoses.
And it takes a toll on, it's clear from your book, it takes a toll not just on the patients who have to have things said that are insensitive or somebody's kind of slouching against the door wall and kind of delivers some bad news and slouches out again, but it takes a toll on the caregivers.
You know, I'm so glad that you point that out, because that was truly the biggest revelation to me in writing the book. And when I sat with all of the events that happened and really looked at them in retrospect, I realized how much suffering was happening for providers, that, you know, myself included, when I lost patients that I wanted more than anything to help, there was no place to go with that. I didn't feel I could talk about it in a way that would promote my own healing. It's just not our culture. We move on to the next patient, whether it's in the next ICU bed or in the next clinical encounter. It's just what we do.
Well, and it strikes me that the things that make a physician a good physician, battling disease, treating it as you know, as an enemy to be destroyed, that takes a toll.
Absolutely. I think that whole paradigm that we've set up, where it is a war on cancer, it is a battle to be fought, that even that language can be harmful, not just for the patients, who then feel that if they're not quote unquote fighting, that they're giving up, but also for the physician, because if they're in a war against something, that's the only paradigm then, is to win or lose. And I think we have to reframe the language. We have to begin to think about it in terms of truly partnering and walking alongside our patients in the same direction through the illness rather than fighting against something.
I'm speaking with Dr. Rena Audish. Her memoir is In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. She is a critical care medicine specialist who wound up on the other side of the equation as a patient in and out of intensive care units for years, the intensive care unit at the hospital where she worked at Henry Ford Hospital. And you now run a program at Henry Ford called CLEAR Conversations. What does CLEAR stand for?
CLEAR stands for Connect, Listen, Empathize, Align, and Respect. And it really is the value system that we seek to embody in all of our training. So we believe that true healing happens in the context of a relationship, and that we must cultivate that connection with our patients, that we have to listen generously. We have to know what matters to our patients. We have to empathize when emotion enters the conversation, which I think traditionally physicians aren't as well trained to do. We stay in the cognitive channel much more than we do the emotional channel. We try to align with patient goals, which of course means knowing what matters to our patients, knowing what their values are, and then respect those values. So never put forth a treatment plan that isn't in alignment with what the patient would want for their life. There's so much that medicine can offer these days, but if it isn't in the context of what our patients want, it's relatively meaningless. We're doing it for ourselves then.
I'm wondering, do you see room for humor from physicians and nurses, the kind that helps them blow off the stress? You know what I'm talking about, that kind of dark humor.
You know, that was the only coping mechanism that I think was modeled to me in all of my training. And to me, it's sad that that was all that we had. We had that ability to joke about something and this sort of graveyard humor that sometimes happens in healthcare. But I really think it's a sign of a deeper level of distress that people don't necessarily know what to do with. And that's what's socially sanctioned within medicine, is that joking. And I'd like to see where we can get past that and talk really honestly about our feelings in a more constructive way.
It is quite a powerful book. And it is good to know that you and your family did have the happy ending of eventually having your little boy, Walt. And by the way, your husband, Randy, Saint Randy.
Oh, he'll appreciate that. Thank you.
Doctor, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Dr. Rana Oudish, her memoir is In Shock, My Journey from Death to Recovery and the Redemptive Power of Hope. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.